Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On the program today, a fiery green resignation.
It was not easy. It has been extremely painful. It has been the worst period in my life in many respects.
Anna Meepal resigns as Green Party leader with startling allegations that her own party destroyed her leadership. Did the Greens really sabotage their leader? And how does the party rebuild now? In moments, we'll bring on Anna Meepal's executive assistant and the former interim leader of the Green Party of Canada. And then hostage diplomacy. How does Canada now deal with China after the return of the two Michaels?
It may feel foreign to them that the Department of Justice is independent, but it is independent under this administration. And this is a legal matter. It was an announcement made by the Department of Justice.
Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor are back home after 1,019 days in a Chinese prison. Their release came hours after the U.S. resolved charges against Huawei executive CFO Meng Wanzhou. She also flew back to China. But how does Canada now deal with that country? Will Canada finally ban Huawei from being part of the 5G network? MPs are going to debate the future of Canada's relationship with a superpower. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players.
When I was elected and put in this role, I was breaking a glass ceiling. What I didn't realize at the time is that I was breaking a glass ceiling that was going to fall on my head and leave a lot of shards of glass that I was going to have to crawl over, throughout my time as a leader. And when I arrived at that debate stage, I had crawled over that glass. I was spitting up blood, but I was determined to be there. I was determined to be there so that the next time someone like me thinks of running and wonders whether it's possible to be on that stage, they will know that it is possible to do that.
It was a green resignation of a leader who was seeing fiery red at her own party. When Anna Meepal announced today that she was resigning as leader, on the surface, it was not a surprise. Anna Meepal, who was elected last October as the leader, a lawyer, an accomplished diplomat, still, she failed to win a seat in Parliament for the third time. She came in fourth in her riding of Toronto Centre, which was won again by the Liberals. And across Canada under her leadership, though the Greens elected an MP for the first time in Ontario, they made history there in Kitchener Centre, their vote nationally collapsed. The Green Party went from 6.5% of the popular vote in 2019 to 2.3% of the vote in 2021. In other words, their vote dropped by more than 790,000 people. And to make things worse, the Greens lost a key seat on Vancouver Island, and the MP who then crossed the floor under Paul's leadership to join the Liberals won her seat in Fredericton. But Ms. Paul alleged that the disastrous results were actually a result of attacks on her and on her leadership from her own party, that she was undermined by it. Check this out.
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that when you head into an election without funding for your campaign, when you head into an election without the staff to staff your campaign, when you head into an election without a national campaign manager, when you head into an election being, again, under the threat of a court process from your party, it's going to be very hard to convince people to vote for your party.
Ms. Paul also did not leave any doubt that the Green Party of Canada is in turmoil. She said there's literally a struggle for the soul of her party, her words. So where does that leave the Greens? We asked for an interview with Anna Meepal. She was unavailable. So was the former leader of that party, Elizabeth May. But joining us now is Victoria Galli. She's Anna Meepal's executive assistant and just ran as a Green Party candidate for Hamilton West, Ancaster, Dundas. First of all, thank you so much for joining us. I know this is a difficult day. Your reaction to Anna Meepal's resignation and her characterization that the Green Party campaign was literally undermined from within.
Thank you for having me on, Evan. The party absolutely undermined this campaign at every step, both the local Toronto Centre campaign and the national campaign. It's very hard to have a campaign when all of your staff has been laid off for weeks approaching the election. You don't have a national campaign manager, and the party provided you with zero funding in order to have a campaign. So undermining is almost an understatement.
Okay, when did this start? Sources have told me that the party was actually in reasonably good shape. You know, just so people understand, there is something called a voter rebate. So parties that get more than 2.5%, the Greens got 6.5% in 2019, they actually can get a bank loan. I understand from sources that for this election, the Green Party had $1.3 million in a bank loan to fund it. So were the resources not available? What happened to hamper Anna May Paul and the planning of this campaign?
Absolutely. I'd say that the envelopes were heavily stipended and not given out ahead of time with the guise of we don't know when the election will officially be called, which everyone in the political realm knew it was going to happen before September, with sources everywhere telling us that that was the case, especially leading off of the other provincial election right into our election. I think that the party did not want to provide us with the money in order to siphon our success. There's absolutely no reason for them to lay off half of our staff leading into election, including the entire leader's office. We out fundraised every single quarter, including the month of June when Jenica left, over the year before. And so it was not a money inflow issue. It was a money mismanagement issue.
So why was she being undermined? Like, what is at the root of this? She was elected as a new leader. She performed very well, by all accounts, in the debate. She's an accomplished lawyer, an accomplished diplomat. Who was undermining her and why?
Absolutely. The previous federal council at every turn took each opportunity to undermine her. I think that throwing things like votes of non-confidence, talking about reviewing her leadership, her membership as a leader. And there's so many turns that every day we were waking up to a new issue, and every day it was becoming a joke. Like, it can't get worse than it is now, but yet every day it did. And so
triggered it, Victoria? I've heard that, Ms. Paul has said that, and you've said that they were undermined by counsel. There's been lots of leaked stories. But why? Like, what precipitated the fact that counsel was turning on Anna May Paul? Like, what precipitated this? Why were they doing this, in your view?
It's hard to tell the exact moment that it occurred when, from day one, the federal council did not seek to have Anna May Paul's success. No matter which leader turned that election win back on October 3rd, the first questions were about, is she going to fire our previous executive director the next day? So the federal council has never set her up for success. But I would say the instance, of course, of Jenica leaving did act as a catalyst for these issues. I absolutely think we still would have ended up here. All roads led to this path when you're not supported in your own party, even though you were democratically elected to be the leader.
Did Elizabeth May support her?
I think that there were instances where we could have seen more support and it was lacking. And I think that that silence has been deafening over the months. And there definitely could have been more room cleared from the outgoing leader for our new leader to have growth and success in this election.
She is the leader, though. I mean, she lost Jenica Atwin, the only elected leader, member, of course, in Fredericton. We've heard that she didn't talk very much to Elizabeth May. Elizabeth May told us on air that she hadn't talked to her in months. Paul Manley said she didn't have a lot of contact. Jenica Atwin told me that Anna May Paul didn't talk to her. Does she bear any responsibility for not communicating with her caucus, not building support, not doing the job of a leader?
I think that there's some misrepresentation about a lot of those situations. The single time that Jenica's team, as far as I know, did reach out to Madame Paul to have that phone call was the same day Madame Paul found out at the horrendous tweets that Jenica did tweet against Anna May. And I think that she did not want to speak to her out of anger and upset and said that very clearly. I would like to speak with you, but today I'm not okay with doing that and let's connect later. And our office repeatedly reached out to Jenica's office in the weeks following and did not receive any response.
But you wonder if that was too late. Anna May Paul said today there's a struggle for the soul of the Green Party. What is the struggle for the soul of the Green Party?
I think we're at a crossroads from the intersectionality we face in reality of the climate crisis and in things like environmental racism and social justice and the actual will and action to do so when the party is being led in all areas, essentially, other than by the leader they disowned by white people. It's hard to show that we are also a social justice party. And so for that soul and will and power to move forward as a progressive party and be seen as the option for the left, it is a fight for the soul of the party.
Was racism an issue for Anna Mee Paul?
Absolutely.
Because she said she was attacked from within, that race was an issue. Were there basically people, are you saying that there are people who were racist inside the Green Party and used that to undermine Anna Mee Paul?
Yes, I think absolutely that occurred. And I think that it's not just an opinion at this point. When Ombuds, a third party entity, reviews internal emails and discussions and says that point blank racist allegations were made unfounded and defamatory against the leader of your party and these federal councils should resign and then did not proceed to do so for months at a time, that's a direct racist act, let alone the microaggressions of not hiring new equity, diversity, inclusion candidates, seeking out new candidates, having funding for these things, let alone firing our equity, diversity, inclusion director, Zara. So there were micro and macro aggressions that took place of racism in the party.
Finally, you know, in politics, leaders take accountability. Does Anna Mee Paul accept any responsibility for the fact that the Green vote went from 6.5% to 2.3%? It was a disastrous campaign. I know there's lots, clearly she says there's a lot of internal issues. I get that. What responsibility as the leader does she bear?
I think that no politician is perfect and we all work to strive from our mistakes, but I think absolutely all roads led to this result. At every turn, Anna Mee, it's a grassroots party. Anna Mee is a single voice on our federal council. A single representative sits on her behalf on the campaign working group. No national campaign manager was assigned and no money was spent on Toronto Centre or the national campaign. And so I think to say that this is entirely her fault is completely inaccurate. And I think that no matter how many adjustments she could have made or tweaked her communication skills or whichever you'd like to point to, we still would be in this situation.
Did she know that she was going to lose Toronto Centre in fourth place before the campaign? Do you guys have internal polling saying we're not going to even be able to win our own riding?
Personally, I never saw the internal polling, but I think that we're getting close to the feeling from the ground. People want to support us. It was a minority election where people were scared of a liberal or conservative minority, and strategic voting definitely played a role. And so it wasn't a clear outcome, but I think we were accepting that point.
Victoria Galli, I really appreciate you taking the time and speaking about that, someone who worked very closely with Anna Mee Paul and who ran as well as a Green Party candidate. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
My pleasure. Okay, let's turn to someone who led the Green Party just before Anna Mee Paul. Joanne Roberts was the interim Green Party leader after Elizabeth May stepped down. She was also a Green Party candidate in Halifax in last week's election and is now the vice chair for the Heartwood Institute. Joanne, good to have you back on the program. You heard that last interview. Anna Mee Paul and her staff saying they were undermined from the beginning. There is racist inside the party. It was divided. And basically, the campaign was destroyed internally. What do you make of that?
Well, I thank Victoria for coming on and speaking so bluntly. And I think I also thank Anna Mee for her leadership. You know, you asked, did she take responsibility? She didn't take sole responsibility, but she did pay quite an ultimate price. She is going to be stepping down as leader. She's now starting that process of transition. So that's a pretty high price when you had hoped that you would be able to lead the party. So I think she's done the right thing, but it is very painful to hear the reasons behind it.
Were you aware of these reasons? I mean, you're the former leader, interim leader. Like, were you aware of the deep divisions? Did you know she was being, do you agree that she was being hampered, undermined, and attacked by council?
I didn't know that firsthand because council moved to have me they removed my position from council very quickly after Anna Mee was brought in as leader. But I do know from my time as interim leader that the party was struggling, and from hearing Victoria, is still struggling to make the transition, if I can put it that way, to the next level of politics. For example, the Greens were starting to build a caucus, and it was being more than just a leader and an internal party, because when Elizabeth May was elected, Elizabeth could be the voice in Parliament and also, have a pretty firm hand on how internal politics was run. That's not sustainable. That's not how you're going to build and grow as a party. And Elizabeth knew that. But I think for those who served on council, at least the former council, that was the struggle. oh, who is this leader who doesn't want to come to all these meetings? Who is, you know, because Elizabeth had done that. And it wasn't Elizabeth so much doing it, was the comparison with Elizabeth. So I do think
so,
I felt that myself. Yeah. I certainly struggled with that.
Okay, so what, did she do enough work with caucus? Did she speak to, did she support candidates? I mean, the Greens didn't run almost 85 candidates in 85 different ridings. I think that's the first time that's happened since 2004. Was she a good leader? Did she do the job as a leader?
It depends what the job of leader is that you want her to do. I think we will thank years from now Anna Mee Paul for the work she did on the Green Party. We'll be a better party because of what we learned from her, and she had a lot to say today, and I think we should listen. But did she get the part of it that says, you know, you have to fight to keep staff in place because you don't have staff, you don't get people to run for office? Did we have a more diverse slate of candidates? We certainly did, and she did that job. Did she support her caucus? She certainly was working in that direction. I don't think anyone's going to try and defend what happened in the disagreement between Anna Mee's office and caucus over what Noah Zatzman said. But she wouldn't be the first leader who's had a difficulty. She had no runway to work past learn from.
Okay, so we're just real quick, because you're the former Green Party leader, Joanne Roberts. Where do you go from here? Like, can the Green Party is now down to 2.3%? There's a struggle for the soul of the party.
We do get that rebate, which, believe me, there's a lot of Greens who heaved a sigh of relief when we got over the 2%. You know, the Conservatives, you probably are too young to remember this, but they were down to 2 members at one point, and they managed to rebuild. I think what we do now is what our Constitution calls for. We work with Anna Mee to make the transition. The Federal Council will appoint an interim leader, and 6 months from the date of the resignation, we have to by then have started a leadership race. But we have to learn from this. We have to start repairing and rebuilding this party.
Well, first of all, I thank you for saying I'm too young to remember when it was just Elsie Wayne and Jean Charest, post Mulroney and post Kim Campbell. But I will remind you that the Progressive Conservatives, then they went under Joe Clark, and they were folded eventually into the Conservative Party, so that the PC Party actually ceased existing after that. So I don't know if that's necessarily the comparison, but Joanne Roberts, I always appreciate you joining us. Good to have you back on the program as the former interim party leader and candidate. Congratulations on putting your hat back in the ring, though. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
And I do remember that story. A developing story we are following, though, today. Rescue teams are working to free at least 39 workers who have been trapped underground in a mine in Sudbury, Ontario, since Sunday. Vale, the company that owns the mine, says there was an incident in the shaft of the Totten mine yesterday, causing a problem with the conveyance system that's used to transport workers. The miners are apparently now working with rescue teams on a ladder system. They're expected to reach the surface by tonight, and we wish them safety and well. Coming up, back home, but what's next? Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor are back home. Where does Canada go from here in relationships with China? MPs debate that next. Stay with Power.
As the resolution for Ms. Meng was heading towards success, and the parties to that discussion felt that they were heading towards success, the Chinese government made its decision. And its decision was that it was no longer, you know, in its interest to continue holding the Michaels. And so they started the process in talking to our officials in Beijing about making arrangements to have the Michaels leave.
Kind of remarkable. That's a conversation I had on CTV's Question Period yesterday with Kirsten Hillman, the Canadian ambassador to the U.S., who said China started the discussions to release the two Michaels. But it was 1,019 days for Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig. They were imprisoned in China. And that's probably about as long as relationships between Canada and China have been officially in disarray. But now that the two Michaels are home, should there and can there be a reset with China? Where does Canada go from here, dealing with a country that clearly uses hostage diplomacy. A panel of MPs joins us now. Rob Oliphant joins us for the Liberals. Conservative Garnet Janis joins us. And for the NDP, Jenny Kwan is here. Great to have the three of you. And by the way, congratulations on all of your re-elections. I know that's a lot of work. Mr. Oliphant, how does Canada change its relationship with China? For example, will Canada finally make a decision on whether or not Huawei can be part of Canada's 5G or not?
Well, I think we begin by first congratulating my colleagues, Garnet and Jenny, on their wins. They don't look any worse for the wear, I feel. I must. But we're back. And I think before the election, during the election and after the election, the relationship with that Canada has with China continues to be challenging. It was challenging before. Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor were arbitrarily detained and held, taken hostage, really, for almost 3 years. And it continues to be difficult. It is a complex relationship. It will take perseverance, just as we have shown in the last number of years on this particular issue. We never gave up, and we did it with persistence and with very measured, no rhetoric, but trying to find ways to find a solution. And we did it with our partners. So we have worked on the arbitrary detention issue with dozens of other countries. And I think that what happened was, as Ambassador Hillman said, it was not in the interest of China to hold Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig any longer, because the world was watching. And that was the effective diplomacy of Dominic Barton, of Ambassador Hillman, of our ministers of foreign affairs and our prime minister. We continually gathered people around us, countries around us, and showed that this was not in China's best interest to do this. And we'll continue to do that. But we can't say that it's going to be easy going ahead. We will still be challenging them on human rights issues. We will continue to challenge them on their treatment of Hong Kong and Hong Kongers. We'll continue to hold up the issue of Tibet around the world stage. And we'll continue to do that. We'll also find ways where we coexist with them, where we compete with them, and sometimes where we cooperate with them. This is, I think, the difference that the Liberal Party has brought into this equation, is that we have a complex relationship that takes nuance, it takes strategy, and it takes persistence and patience. And I think that now we have shown a good result from that.
Garnet, I mean, your party criticized the government for, quote, doing nothing on this to get the Michaels. Then the two Michaels are home. They work with the United States. They got home. Is this a vindication that this is a complicated issue dealing with China? And, you know, Canada did build allies. They did have a treaty against arbitrary detention. Ambassadors did show up outside the trials. Is this a vindication of the government's strategy, Garnet?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to say how pleased we are, and Canadians of all political persuasions are so pleased that the two Michaels are home. And we credit the work done by our diplomats on this, and certainly the role that other countries played. Evan, I think it's also important to note that there still are Canadians facing arbitrary detention in China. There's the case of Hussein Khalil, for example, that we've continually brought up, and continually the government has seemed not to place the same emphasis on this case in instances where the government mentions the cases of some Canadians detained in China, but not others. So now that the two Michaels are home, we're going to continue our advocacy for Canadians who continue to face arbitrary detention. I would say respectfully that the government has been missing in action on many important files in the context of this relationship. We would still like to know the government's position on the Uyghur genocide. We would still like to know the government's position on Huawei, because those security concerns have not disappeared. They're still very much alive, and all of our Five Eyes allies have made a determination that including Huawei in their networks is dangerous, and the Canadian government hasn't yet been willing to take a position on that. So these are some important outstanding issues. And then we had most recently, just very, very quickly, we had the case of the U.S., Australia, and the U.K. signing an agreement around security cooperation in the Pacific. President Biden saying that the U.S. has no closer or more reliable ally than Australia. So I think it's important for Rob to answer the question, is Canada part of that alliance? Was Canada invited to be part of that alliance and they refused, or was Canada simply not invited? Where are we at in terms of cooperation with our allies and some of these security issues going forward?
Okay, we can certainly talk about that. But I want to talk about, and what about Jenny Kwan? Michaels are home. How does Can Canada, should Canada reset a Canada-China relationship? And if so, what does that mean?
Well, first off, like my colleagues, congratulations to everyone for your re-election. But equally important, I think, is, of course, the fact that the two Michaels are home. And so this is really, really important to note. Now, we should also note that Canada, all the way through, followed the rule of law, followed due process. Even Ms. Meng herself acknowledged that in her own statement. Now, I wish we could say the same for China. And what we know is that they exercise hostage diplomacy. And so going forward, there's a real question for Canada to consider this kind of behavior, this kind of practice, and how best to deal with it. I think that this situation has really illustrated to us the importance of Canada working with our ally countries consistently and persistently. And so not only just on this file, but I think on many other files going forward as well. And we have to take into consideration of what's happened here with the two Michaels. It's true that it is great that they are home. Absolutely. And every Canadian, I believe, wanted to see them return safely. But we also know, based on the actions of China, that we believe that they exercise hostage diplomacy. How do you deal with that going forward? That is the key question that we have to come to grips with. The other thing, too, that I do think we have to make some decisions on the 5G network, that's a key decision that should be made now that the two Michaels are home. We also should be looking at the issue around using consultants, if you will, or using, visa offices stationed in China operated by the Chinese. I think that that is a key question in terms of the renewal of the visa offices in China for Canada. Those are key questions that we have to come to grips with.
I just have just a couple seconds, and Mr. Oliphant, I just thought both MPs mentioned a real key question. When will your government make a decision on Huawei and whether or not they're part of Canada's 5G? Our allies have said no. When will Canada make that call?
I think it's important to remember that we do work with all our allies, particularly in the Five Eyes. We are engaged in conversations all the time. On the Huawei 5G decision, it is divorced from politics. What we are trying to do is find a way to ensure that Canadians and Canadian security is paramount in this decision. We want to ensure that decisions are based on the best protection of intellectual property and making sure that we will continue to have a safe and secure internet system in our country. And that decision rests with a number of partners. I'm not engaged in that decision. It is outside our hands, but it will be a technical decision. It will be advice to the government based on that, and the government will do that. And I'm very happy to hear my colleagues' opinions on it, but we move beyond opinion on this, and this will be what is in the best interest of Canada and Canadians, and that's
the government.
I know we're out of time, but I will say we are years behind our allies on that Huawei decision. So just on that, Canada's way behind. And then I know Mr. Garnet Janis referenced Mr. Chalil, who's been imprisoned since 2006. For 15 years he's been in prison there, just so people who are asking should know. Mr. Oliphant, Mr. Janis.
That is a case that is constantly under review. But as Mr. Janis knows, China refuses to recognize his Canadian citizenship. Right. Yeah. That's the clear issue. We recognize
China. I had asked the foreign affairs minister if this issue had been raised with the Biden administration. I would hope that our government, having raised the case of the two Michaels with the Biden administration and seeking their help, would have done the same on the case of Mr. Chalil.
Right. Okay. And by the way, it was not mentioned, other detainees. We didn't hear it about Mr. Barton raising that. But okay, I really appreciate the three of you. I know I got to get moving because coming up, the state of the Canada-China relations are at a crossroads, as you can see from these three MPs. And I want to get former diplomat Ben Rosewell on our press gallery next to weigh in on that. So we got lots more to come. Stay with us.
Feeling, Michael?
Fantastic, thank you very much. Fantastic, congratulations. I'm immensely grateful for everybody. We'll have much more to do.
Pretty remarkable moment. That's Michael Kovrig. Both he and Michael Spav are back home on Canadian soil, but as we were just debating with MPs before the break, Canada's relationship with China clearly still very tricky. Now that the Michaels are free, what will change? What can change? The press gallery is here. Stephanie Levitz, a reporter with the Toronto Star's Ottawa Bureau. Ian Bailey, reporter with the Globe's Ottawa Bureau. And our special guest, Ben Rosewell, president of the Canadian International Council, former diplomat. Ben, Stephanie, Ian, great to have you here. Steph, let me just start with you. Obviously, what do you make of the return of the two Michaels and what it means for a Canada-China reset, if that's possible?
I mean, I can't think of a moment in recent Canadian history that has made me so emotional as to watch some of that footage and to see some of the photographs even of the men reunited with their families and what that must mean for them and just to imagine the world through their eyes now after so long in captivity. That's the emotional side. The political cynical side, I know some of your previous guests touched on this, Evan, but this fictional idea put forward by the Chinese that at any point these two were not being effectively held hostage by the Chinese government, which is simply put to rest. And I think that means it's eyes wide open, if it wasn't before, about how not just Canada, but the West deals with China, because they're clearly now signaling what they intend to do, what they're capable of doing if something doesn't go their way.
Yeah, and I'll bring in Ben, but first let me just get Ian, because you watched this too. Ian, the return, remarkable. But it's now going to, what challenges does the Trudeau government have? Now there's going to be Huawei with 5G. How do they reset a relationship with a country that, as Steph said, openly uses hostage diplomacy? They barely tried to mask it. Ian, I think we've lost Ian. Ian, we don't have your audio. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Okay, Ian, try again.
Okay, yeah, it was tremendously gratifying to see these men back in Canada, to hear, I guess, Mr. Kovrig spoke to the media and to hear his voice and to see him so well back at home. As for our relationship, one can only imagine the areas of Canada's relationship with China that have been affected by this captivity. And one will see over time, maybe a new policy unencumbered by the pressure tactic of holding these two men. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out in a number of areas with 5G, with other areas, now that Canada is perhaps has a bit more latitude to proceed without worrying about the effect on these captives.
But you got to, Ben, what does it say? Like, you have to worry about who's the next two Michaels. China today, the fiction that they released them because they were worried about their health. You know, one way to fix their health is not to imprison them and keep the lights on for 24 hours. What do you make of how Canada and the world deals with China now?
Hostage diplomacy. I think this has been a lesson to China. They have paid a huge price for their bullying of Canada. They've got 57 countries that have now signed an international declaration against precisely this kind of practice. And, I mean, we should remind our watchers here that it was China who blinked on this and not Canada. We held firm with our position right through to the end. There was no concessions whatsoever on Canada's part. It was the kidnapper that gave up, not the country, the family of the kidnappees. And so I think on hostage diplomacy, we might still see it. I mean, there has been an erosion of norms around the world on all kinds of issues, and authoritarian governments like Beijing are constantly pushing the envelope and seeing what they can get away with. I think on hostage diplomacy, they saw that Canada was tough and held firm. But that is just one of many challenges that China is going to have to the rules of the international system. And Canada's was able to get through this partly by having really strong relationships with so many other countries. But this has got to serve as a lesson that we have to approach China collectively by using the force of united democracies across the world to ensure that the rules of the international system are respected.
But how does that play out? China's strategy, you know, they'll pick on Australia, they'll pick on Canada. Ben, just real quick, I know there's the international treaty that Canada spurred on arbitrary detention, but what do you think is going to play out as the world is pivoting towards trying to enforce some global norms on China?
Well, you are seeing some shift in the Chinese posture. there just in the last few weeks, there's been some signs coming out of Beijing that there's a recognition that it has frittered away a lot of its power by focusing only on hard power and only on intimidation and the use of force. Don't forget that China killed almost, I think it was more than a dozen Indian soldiers in an unnecessary and unprovoked border skirmish last year. Now it's got a poisonous relationship with its largest neighbor. It has blown the chance of getting a major trade pact with the European Union, again, through its constant escalation and aggressive diplomatic rhetoric. It has turned Australia into an enemy state, practically, now acquiring nuclear-powered submarines. And we're seeing some signals coming up from the very top from Xi Jinping that actually maybe this World Warrior diplomacy has gone a little far. It plays great in the domestic audience, and there's been some reasons for the Chinese regime to doubt the strength of the support of the Chinese people, but it pays a terrible price in international affairs for that. Now, I think there's some domestic drivers to Chinese foreign policy that will make it continue to be aggressive,
right.
But you are seeing China recognize when many states start turning against it, it changes its behavior. It's done so on hostage diplomacy, and I think I think we've shown that there's unity, there's strength in unity when we approach China.
Yeah, you're right, and they do call it the wolf warrior diplomacy. Steph, the most urgent question will be, when will Canada make a decision on Huawei, and will that cause another blowback?
Well, I mean, you know, to take Ben's point, if we're looking at a world now where it's China versus everybody else, I mean, everybody else has already taken a position on Huawei. Right. So will the decision Canada makes at this point have any effect here, there, or anywhere? I think at this point what Canada just simply needs to do is make a decision. I mean, dragging your feet out on thing after thing perhaps is a hallmark of this Liberal government, but it's time to just, I don't know what the word is or what the analogy is. Just make the call. Whatever technical decision needs to get made, make it, and let's move on.
Yeah, and last word to you, Ian. I mean, there is going to have to be, and then the incoming ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Canada, Mr. Cohen, was saying, I'm waiting for a new articulation of a Canada-China policy. When do you think we see something like that? How urgent is that?
It's definitely urgent. You know, the Prime Minister has not had an extensive news conference since just before the election, I suppose. Obviously, brief remarks on Friday, but presumably he'll go before the media in coming days, and we'll get some broad hints about where we're going on China. And wherever we go, the Canadian public will remember these events, and the government will be mindful of what the public thinks, and the government will be guided by these events. And so it's all going to have a significant effect going forward on how Canada deals with China, in my view.
I think it's pretty clear there's going to be a pre-Two Michaels diplomacy and a post-Two Michaels strategy, and I think Canadians will see those two worldviews. Okay, Ben Rosewell, always a pleasure to have you on the program, sir. I know Steph and Ian are going to stick around, because when we come back, the green resignation of Anna Meepal. She leaves the job, but she says her party sabotaged her. We'll find out more. The former Liberal MP, Selena Arcivez, Cesar Chavan, will join us on the press gallery next. Stay with us. She lost her seat. She lost the election. They lost popular support. The Greens went from 6.5% in the last election to 2.3% this time. But today, Anna Meepal, in her fiery resignation speech as leader of the Green Party, said she was undermined by attacks within her own party. We just had one of her executive assistants say that there was racism at the core of it. Is this, she said, Anna Meepal said, I broke a glass ceiling, and then the glass ceiling fell on my head. So what is the truth here? Was she a good leader, or was she undermined because she was the first black female leader of a federal party in Canada? Let's bring back the press gallery to try to sort this out. Stephanie Levitz, a reporter with the Toronto Star, Ian Bailey with the Globe, and our special guest who knows a thing or two about politics is Selena Cesar Chavan, senior advisor of equity, diversity, and inclusion at Queen's University, former Liberal MP. Great to have you all here. Selena, always a pleasure to have you back on the program. What did you make of Anna Meepal's rather remarkable resignation speech today, and what she said basically, I was undermined. I was destroyed by attacks within my own party.
I think Canadians saw that play out in living color over the last little while. I am disappointed in myself that I was shocked and surprised, because inevitably, you know, that is what we've seen unfold for women of color, especially Black women within politics. And, you know, she's a fighter. She's smart. She's a fighter. She would have landed very well to our political discourse. Unfortunately, we didn't see that play out because of what was happening internally to the party.
So, Selena, let me just ask you, I just asked one of her senior allies, I said, was racism a factor? She said, of course it was. In your view, was it, I mean, there's a lot of things that go into the resignation results, and you know this better than anyone. But in your view, is this emblematic of what it's like to be a female leader, a female of color leader? And was that a factor in her political fate?
So let's just put all things aside. We could disagree on policy. We could disagree on process. We could disagree on a number of different things. But the way that you treat people is a fundamental underlying core of our democracy. And the way she was treated as a woman of color, as a Black woman, I don't think any party leader in the history of this country has experienced that. So yes, this was actually what misogyny noir, which is the racism and sexism against Black women in particular, this is what that looks like when you completely destroy someone who you know is smart, is totally capable, is more than has the capacity to do the job. And now she has to leave because of an internal infrastructure that said, we will be damned if you stay. And that is unfortunate. It's unfortunate for Canadians, and it's more than unfortunate for the Green Party of Canada.
Steph, you watched politics for a long time. There was a lot of internal griping that she didn't talk to her caucus, that she wasn't a good leader internally. There was also the equal side that said she was undermined for reasons of gender, race, and that it would there was she never had the support. How do you interpret what happened to Anna Meepal, and what's your reaction to that extraordinary resignation speech she gave?
Well, I'd also like to note that Anna Meepal was also the first Jewish woman who was a leader of a federal political party, and we can't just wipe that away. We can't discount her faith in this and the very real politics and nasty politics over Israel and Palestine issues that also played a role in her departure. Let's not sideline that. But I think Selena made a really good point that you have to set aside, what happened. You can't look at it only through one lens. Did Anna Meepal make the right decision to seek a seat in Toronto Centre? Was that a smart political decision? Probably it wasn't, given what was happening in that riding with the strength of the Liberal Party. Should, for example, Elizabeth May have stepped aside, given Anna Meepal a chance to run in her very safe Green seat? Perhaps. Why didn't Elizabeth May do that? Well, then you get into a whole bunch of other questions about what's going on in that party and what was facing Anna Meepal. So was she given the chance to be the leader that she could have been? Were people there to actually support her, lift her up, give her the best conditions possible to win? I think absolutely not.
Ian, where does the Green Party go from here? She says there's a struggle for the soul of the Green Party.
You know, before coming to sit in this seat, I was looking at the Green Party website, and Anna Meepal is still the leader. Her biography is still there. There's no acknowledgement of the remarkable events of today. I think the Green Party has a lot of explaining to do, but for reasons including apparent litigation, the party's federal council has not been very nimble or fulsome in explaining these matters and how we've come to this point. I think the Green Party is going to be living this down for quite some time. I think whoever seeks the leadership of this party is going to be dealing with these events. The next leader will be dealing with them. You know, Ms. Paul, a bilingual lawyer, you know, tremendous professional credentials, would have been a candidate or a leader, you know, for other parties as well. So it's quite unfortunate that this end has come and that she's left public life for whatever reason.
Okay, Selena, she said that statement, I think we'll never forget it, when she said, I broke the glass ceiling and the glass ceiling fell on my head and then I ended up spitting blood. Remarkable statement that she made. But then she said, I hope someone else picks up the baton. Selena, what message, like, look what happened to Annamie Paul. What message is this sending to Canadians? What does it say about our political process?
That part of her speech hit me hard, Evan, and I just hope that Canadians give Annamie Paul the grace that she deserves. To Stephanie's point, she did not back down. She did not choose an easy riding. She wanted to represent the people and community that she loved. And she's a fierce individual, and I just hope she gets that grace. Somebody who puts their name on a ballot, who decides they want to step up and serve our country in its democracy, should not be treated that way. And I think this is what Canadians really need to remember. Nobody needs to feel like they've crawled over shard glass and it fell on their head. And they should not feel like that, to run and to represent people. So I hope that she's given the grace that she deserves, and that Canadians remember this as a defining leadership moment.
Yeah, I will say this. We all cover politics. You've been involved in it very personally. Sometimes it can be a very inhumane business, and at its worst anyway. Selena, Cesar, Siobhan, Steph Levitz, Ian Bailey, the three of you, I really appreciate you joining us today. Thanks so much. That is your Power Play Day in Politics for all of you. Thanks so much for watching. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. The two Michaels are home. Hug your loved ones. It's a great gift. See you tomorrow.